In 1966, in the sleepy town of Oudendalsrus in the Free State, two 12-year-old girls, cousins Isifori and Petronelle, are kidnapped and murdered. Issy's brother vows to leave no stone unturned in his quest for justice for his sister and cousin. And although it would take more than 20 years, he kept that promise. But the fallout of the brutal murders would take its toll regardless, and the families and communities involved would never be the same. In a brand new drama series based on these true crime events, CakeNet explores this case in the series Nichies. A new episode of Nichies airs every Tuesday on CakeNet, DSTV channel 144 at 8 p.m. And you can catch up with any episodes you've missed on DSTV Stream and Catch Up. He's a human chameleon, moving through life, becoming who he needs to be to get what he wants. He's gotten away with it so many times that it seems clear to him now that he can do whatever he likes, take what he wants, even a life, if need be. He's wrong, though, and he's about to find out that every streak has its end. And his is coming. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 186, The Murder of Marleen Konings. This episode is sponsored by The Bed Store. Is your bed holding you back from the best sleep ever? The Bed Store offers a variety of bed sets and mattresses from trusted brands like Sealy, 40 Winks and Restonic. With 23 stores across Gauteng and KZN and an online shop, finding your dream bed has never been easier. Visit www.thebedstore.co.za and give your bed the upgrade it deserves. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Cindy DeBeer and Charmy Berger for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. This episode was first published in the Patreon feed in December 2021. The audio has been remastered, but you are hearing Nicole from 2021. if you happen to notice a difference in delivery.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Marlene Koenigs was 24 years old in July of 2003 when she received the news that she'd been selected for a foreign exchange program with PenTech, the Peninsula Technikon in South Africa. Marlene was a third-year student in electromedia at Saxion Hogeschool, a university of applied sciences in Enschede in the eastern part of the Netherlands. The university she attended was 30 kilometers from Winterswijk, the town she lived in with her mother, Josie, father, Edwin, and younger sister, Lotta. Winterswijk is a picturesque little town, and I have no doubt that Marlene grew up with very few concerns about her safety. In general, the Netherlands is one of the safest countries in the world, with its average crime rating as at 2021 at only 27.16, according to the website worldpopulationreview.com. South Africa's rating on that site is 76.86. Although Marlene was level-headed and smart enough to behave responsibly in a foreign country, her mother Josie did harbour some concerns about the trip. Her daughter would be gone for 6 months, but she consoled herself with the fact that several of Marlene's friends would be accompanying her, including a German student called Eva Schaefers, her good friend Winneke Lobiek, and a love interest of Marlene's, a young man called Jensen. The trip would be a great opportunity for Marlene, as the students would be working on a short film about the AIDS crisis in Africa, and the mark she got for that project would count considerably toward her overall degree result. Of course, besides the academic opportunity, the trip to South Africa would also provide at least a few weeks of downtime in one of the most beautiful landscapes in the world. On the 4th of August 2003, the Koenigs family piled into the car and made the two-hour journey from Winterswijk to Schiphol International Airport in Amsterdam, where Marlene would bid a tearful farewell to her mother, father, and sister, and board a plane, along with her travel companions, to Cape Town, South Africa. I have no doubt that as the close-knit Koenigs family drove away from the airport that day, missing a member, they comforted themselves with the knowledge that the next 6 months would fly by, and they would soon have their beloved Marlene home. In January of 2004, the other members of the group would indeed return to the Netherlands, but Marlene would by then be nothing more than a memory. The group of travelling Dutch and German students hit the ground running when they arrived in Cape Town. They were transported to their residence at PenTech in Bellville and were immediately given their assignments. The film project had to be completed by the 5th of December, so that date became the point to work toward for the young people. When they handed in their project, they would then have a few weeks to travel and enjoy themselves before preparing to fly back in the new year. By October 2003, Marlene and her friends couldn't believe how quickly the time was going. They were well into their projects now and looked forward to handing them in December and getting the results they'd worked so hard for. Their holiday period was also already a hot topic of conversation, and Marlene and her friend Eva had decided they would spend at least part of the time travelling up the Southern Cape coastline. The young women wanted to explore the Garden Route too, a part of South Africa they'd heard so much about. On the 5th of December, Marlene and her fellow students handed in their projects. She and Eva excitedly told the program director at PenTech about their plans for the holiday, and he cautioned them to travel safely. The plan was that the two young women would travel along the coast and explore the Garden Route, and then returned to Cape Town for New Year's Eve, where the rest of their friends, including Jensen, had chosen to stay behind and enjoy more of the local sights. Marlene hired a silver Toyota Taz, and they started their journey along the N2 highway. As there was no rush, if they found a town they thought interesting, they would find accommodation and stay over. Then, on the 19th of December, Eva received a troubling message from home. Her mother had fallen very ill, and she had to return to Germany. The pair immediately returned to Cape Town, and on the 21st of December, Eva flew out of South Africa. Marlene could have stayed in Cape Town at that point. She could have rejoined the rest of the group, and things may have gone very differently. Instead, though, she decided that she still had almost 10 days before the New Year's celebration, and she wasn't going to waste them in the city. Alone, she headed back out on the N2 to complete the trip she'd started with Eva. For the next 4 days, she enjoyed the sights of the Southern Cape coast, and then she decided it was time to start making the journey back to Cape Town. On the 24th of December, she stopped in Mossel Bay and found accommodation at the Parkhouse Lodge. Today, the Parkhouse Lodge costs 4,500 rand per person per night. A sharing room costs 6,000 rand. I'm sure that Marlene would have preferred to stay at a less expensive hotel, but I also know that Mossel Bay in December is packed with tourists, and I'm pretty sure she didn't have much choice about accommodation without a reservation. It may also be for this reason that she ended up having to share a room with someone she didn't know. When Marlene arrived at Parkhouse Lodge, she met another guest there. He was a man at least 20 years older than her, but they got along well and chatted easily. The man, who introduced himself as Rob Crowley, explained that he was from Botswana and he worked in IT in the banking industry there. He was also a pilot, he claimed, and told a rapt Marlene about having survived a plane crash and having his face completely reconstructed as a result. In reality, the only thing real about Rob Crowley was actually his face. The name and backstory were complete fabrications, and Marlene Koenigs had just crossed paths with a very dangerous criminal. To tell you how Rob Crowley, or rather Ferdinand Mostert, because that is his real name, came to be at Parkhouse Lodge that day, we have to go back in time several years. We also need to start with someone else's story, a young man named Michael John Victor. Confused yet? That's okay. Bear with me, and we'll get there in the end. Let's go all the way back to the 16th of June, 1986, when Michael Victor, a young man in his early 20s, decided he'd had enough of his gem dealer father splurging all of his money on his new wife, and he crouched in wait on the first floor of his father's home, armed with a pistol and an extra magazine of ammunition. When Michael's father and stepmother entered the home, he opened fire on the couple. He would end up firing 13 bullets into his victims and killing both. Michael, perhaps due to mitigating circumstances around the murders, was only sentenced to 18 years in prison. In a time where a crime of double premeditated murder could easily have earned him the death penalty, he definitely got off easy. During his time in Zonnewater prison, he would meet and come to idolize several older and much more experienced criminals. Among them was one Ferdinand Mostert. Mostert could spin a tale like no other, and Michael was not surprised to hear the man was behind bars for fraud. Michael would end up serving just 7 years behind bars for the murder of his father and stepmother, and was released on parole in 1996. Michael seemed interested in keeping his nose clean, though, and got a job at a furniture factory. When Ferdinand Mostert was released from jail the following year, he reconnected with his young friend. He, it seemed, was also interested in finding the straight and narrow, and he began attending counselling sessions with the local pastor. Unfortunately, after one session, when the pastor found several items missing from his office, he realized that Mostert was very far from rehabilitated. In fact, he'd wasted no time in going back to his old thieving ways. In Mostert's case, the concept of rehabilitation was almost laughable. The man had started his criminal career in 1979, and by 1997, he'd racked up a massive 18 various cases, including fraud, theft, and housebreaking. He was the epitome of a career criminal. On the 25th of April 1997, Mostert arranged to use Michael's buggy for the day and then to collect his friend from his place of work. The pair were going out for a night on the town, and a colleague of Michael's saw the two drive off together. When young Michael did not arrive at work the next day, his colleague called his cell phone. But it wasn't Michael that answered. It was Ferdinand Mostert. Mostert told the woman on the line that Michael couldn't come to the phone because he had food poisoning, but he'd be at work later on. Michael never did arrive for work, and his cell phone was never answered again. A week later, a motorist pulled over close to Hot Beersport Dam to change a flat tire. In the vegetation on the side of the road, the driver discovered the body of 31-year-old Michael Victor. He'd been shot in the back of the head. Police arrived soon after being called, and although there was no identification on the body, they quickly linked him with the missing persons report that had been filed by his co-workers. Police put out an alert for Michael's missing buggy, and 2 weeks later, it was spotted at a resort in Buttplaas. When detectives arrived at the resort, they were surprised to find one MJ Victor was actually signed in as a guest at the resort. Detectives knew, of course, that Michael John Victor was in a morgue in Johannesburg. So who could be here in Buttplaas, booked in under his name? Resort staff pointed out the guest they knew as Michael Victor. The man sitting at the bar sipping beer without a care in the world was eventually identified as Ferdinand Mostert. Mostert had completely assumed Michael's identity. He had his bank card and even his ID, now altered to include a picture of Mostert instead. I can't quite figure out why, but Mostert was not charged with Michael's murder at that time. Perhaps police simply didn't have enough evidence to carry the charge, but he was convicted of fraud. In the 2 weeks since Michael's murder, Mostert had managed to fraudulently spend 20,000 rand using checks in Michael's name and his credit card. He begged for the court's mercy, saying that there was a huge misunderstanding. He claimed that Michael had told him that someone was after him and he was afraid for his life, and if Mostert could completely take over his identity so that he could flee, that would be a great help to him. The court didn't buy it, and he was sentenced to 8 years in jail. If you're already thinking that Mostert was not going to serve that full sentence, and that he was definitely not going to be rehabilitated by his umpteenth visit to prison, you're not going to be disappointed. Ferdinand Mostert would end up serving just 5 years in Los Pasfontein prison before being released. He did put his time there to good use, though, or at least good as far as the definition of that word relates to this man. Mostert had taught himself some computer science skills, and he impressed the warders and other prison officials with his good behaviour and eagerness to teach the other inmates the skills he'd learned. He impressed the staff there so much that when his parole was confirmed, one of the warders, Peter Muhlmann, offered to let the man lodge in his house upon his release. Now, such an offer is commendable, but I do have to wonder if Muhlmann had looked at Morstadt's prior criminal history. If he had, surely he would have realized that this man's modus operandi did not involve going clean. Morstadt had been imprisoned and released on parole many times, and he had managed to accumulate 32 years worth of suspended sentences on his record without ever serving a minute of that time, despite consistently reoffending. I'm sure that Peter Muhlmann felt he was doing a good deed, though, and so it was that Muhlmann, his wife Henriette, and their 3-year-old daughter Roxanne welcomed the ex-convict into their home in Carolina. In the initial weeks after Morstadt moved in, it seemed that the Muhlmann family had made the right choice. The man was charming, helpful, and always arrived home with cigarettes for Henriette and a sweet for Roxanne. In October 2003, when 2,000 kilometers away, Marlene and her friends had been working on their film project, in the Muhlmann house in Carolina, a cloud of sadness had settled. The Muhlmann's lodger, Ferdinand Morstadt, had come home with some devastating news. He had been diagnosed with cancer, and he had just a few weeks to live. He would need intensive, special chemo treatments, he said, and it was only available in Johannesburg and at significant cost. Despite surviving on a meager warder's salary, the Muhlmanns scraped together 10,000 rand, which they gave Morstadt for his treatment, and they told him he could use their bucky when he needed to travel to Johannesburg. A month after the terrible cancer diagnosis, Ferdinand Morstadt seemed to be responding miraculously well to the treatment. So much so that on the 19th of November, he arrived at the Muhlmanns home with a brand new car he claimed to have purchased for a steal, if you'll pardon the pun. In all fairness, we don't actually know where he got that car from, but given his financial situation and his own history, there's a very good chance someone was swindled in order for him to get it. Morstadt claimed, though, that he'd found a car sales place in Machadodorp, where Peter Muhlmann could get his wife a car for less than 15,000 rand. They only accepted cash, though. Peter was very excited. He'd wanted to get his wife a car for some time now, so he withdrew 15,400 rand from their savings, and he and Morstadt headed out to Machadodorp. The pair had only just driven out of Carolina, though, when Morstadt asked Peter if he'd like to try one of the energy tablets his doctor had given him. He said they were part of his regime to fight the cancer he'd been battling, but anyone could take them, and with the long drive ahead, Peter surely needed one. Peter agreed and took the pill Morstadt offered. He woke up several hours later in a hospital in Nelspruit. A motorist had found Peter on the side of the road and called an ambulance. Ferdinand Morstadt, along with the 15,400 rand in cash Peter had withdrawn for the car purchase, were nowhere to be seen. The Muhlmanns were horrified at how deeply they'd been betrayed by Morstadt. Having been left on the side of the road in the heat of a Carolina summer, if the motorist hadn't found Peter and got him medical assistance, he may well have died of exposure before regaining consciousness. Peter Muhlmann opened a case of fraud, theft, and attempted murder against Ferdinand Morstadt. As soon as Morstadt had left the man who had only ever helped him on the side of the road, though, he'd immediately left the area. And by the time Peter had regained consciousness and reported the crime, he was well on his way to the furthest points he could find in the country away from Carolina, the Cape. Along the way, Mostert debated about which of his pseudonyms he should use now. In the past, it would emerge, he'd used several different names, including Rob McFay and Dave McGraw. Each alias had its own very detailed backstory. Of course, all of the characters Mostert played were wealthy professional men, the kind that others would implicitly trust and be impressed by. It's interesting to note that all of Mostert's aliases were very English. Sometimes he even pretended to not be South African at all, but rather Irish. It's likely he would have attempted to change the way he spoke to match the character he was playing, but Mostert was known for having a very heavy Afrikaans accent, so I do wonder how he got away with that one. It would emerge that while Mostert had been living with the Mulman family, he'd also been attempting to build a new life in a town 2 hours away called Volksrust. This is likely where he was going when he claimed to be going for cancer treatments. He'd met a woman in that town, and operating under one of his many aliases, he convinced her to marry him. Shortly before he drugged Pieter Mulman, he'd actually gone through a marriage ceremony with this woman. But unfortunately for Mostert, and very fortunately for his new bride, when they attempted to register the new marriage, Home Affairs questioned his identity. Ferdinand Mostert told his new bride that he was going to get some documents from the car to prove his identity, and he never came back. He left the woman standing there in the Home Affairs office, waiting for her new husband, who she'd fallen deeply in love with, to come back with documents that would prove she hadn't been completely fleeced by a con man. While Mostert drove, he decided that Mossel Bay would be a good place to spend some time. He hadn't been there before, and no one knew him there. He also found a new name to add to his list of aliases while paging through a newspaper on a break from driving. In the obituary section, he found the name Rob Crowley. That would work well, he thought. Mostert's arrival in Mossel Bay just before Christmas in 2003 is the point at which Marlene's story and his collide. I still do not know for sure why Marlene ended up sharing a room with Mostert, but I think perhaps it worked out cheaper, and also perhaps it was the only way to find accommodation. There were two single beds in the room, so we know for certain that Marlene and Mostert were not sharing a bed. Mostert was also more than twice her age, and closer to her father's age. Plus, she and Jensen were still very much an item, and he was waiting for her in Cape Town. It would be this sharing of quarters, though, that made Mostert realize that the young woman he'd just met was rather well off. She had several pieces of expensive electronic equipment, and on Christmas Day, she'd thought nothing of spending a few hundred rand on a bottle of wine for them to share. Mostert's interest was well and truly piqued. Mostert had told Marlene that he was a bit stuck because his car had broken down, but he was also headed for Cape Town. She didn't hesitate to offer the man she knew as Rob Crowley a lift. She'd planned a leisurely drive back to Cape Town, and he could tag along. They could explore the sights on the way back and enjoy the drive. Mostert readily agreed. On the 26th of December, Marlene and Mostert packed the rented Toyota Taz and headed off on the last leg of their trip. The 26th was a Friday, and Marlene had promised to be back in Cape Town on Sunday the 28th. She did not arrive. The events of those days would later be pieced together by police. When the pair had set off on the 26th, Mostert had almost immediately put his plan into action. He slipped the same drug he'd given Pieter Mulman into a bottle of water, but for some reason he ended up taking a sip of it himself. We'll never know whether this was accidental and also why the drug didn't have the same effect on Marlene that it had on Morstad's previous victim. I think it's very likely that Morstad hadn't accounted for the reduced effects that dissolving it in water would have, and perhaps he had two similar bottles of water and only realised after taking a sip he'd drunk from the tampered bottle. Either way, although Marlene did start to feel ill and drowsy, she didn't lose consciousness, and Morstad also started to feel ill. As a result, Marlene decided to book them into a small guest house in Swellendam to rest and recover. She sent her friend Eva, who'd returned to Germany, a message telling her that she and her new friend Rob were on their way back to Cape Town, but they'd seemed to have come down with a case of food poisoning. By Monday morning, Marlene was feeling a little bit better, and the pair drove through the Trudeau Pass. They stopped at the top, with Marlene wanting to take a few photographs, and then scrambled through a wire fence and headed down the slope to the river below. Only Morstad would reascend the slope. Morstad would later claim that while Marlene had her back to him taking photographs, a small buck had emerged from the undergrowth. He said he'd decided to shoot the buck, so he pulled out his weapon and aimed it at the animal. He says that at that moment, Marlene had turned around and seen the weapon. She'd started to scream, he said, and he told her to stop, but she didn't. Instead, she covered her eyes and turned away from him. Then the gun went off, he claims, and a single bullet struck Marlene in the head, killing her instantly. Not only would I not trust a single word that comes out of Ferdinand Morstad's mouth, but none of this fantastic tale makes any sense. Why shoot a buck in the middle of nowhere for no reason? Why would Marlene turn away from a man armed with a gun and cover her eyes? I think that it's very clear that Morstad, having failed in his attempt to drug Marlene, had led her down that slope with the clear intention of killing her. And as soon as her back was turned, he shot her in the back of the head, like the pathetic coward he was. Then he fished the car key from her pocket, stole her digital camera and cell phone, and left her there. When Marlene did not arrive in Cape Town and she wasn't answering her phone, her friend Winika Lobiak phoned Marlene's parents to let them know what was happening, and then she reported her friend missing. To their credit, and likely because a missing tourist would be big news, the police reacted immediately and began to trace Marlene's last movements. On the 3rd of January 2004, the day that the students were supposed to be at Pentec to receive their marks for their project, police appealed to the public for information regarding Marlene's whereabouts. They told the press that she'd last been seen in Mossel Bay on the 26th of December, with a man named Rob Crowley. Dutch authorities sent their own investigators to aid South African police in a move that that country said was standard for a situation of this nature. A highly skilled South African detective, Captain Piet Viljoen, was put in charge of the case, and after the press release, the man would work tirelessly for days, following up on all the leads that had flooded in. Despite the number of very experienced investigators on the case, they were initially baffled when they could find absolutely no information on this person called Rob Crowley. He claimed to have been from Botswana, so police thought perhaps this was why they couldn't find anything about this man, but even authorities in that country knew nothing about him, although he claimed to work in banks in their country. Then, Marlene's credit card was used. One transaction came through in Port Elizabeth and another in Plettenberg Bay. Shortly after this, Marlene's cell phone was used for a single call. Bloemfontein private detective and expert in cell phone data analysis, Leon Rousseau, was asked to assist. Rousseau traced the phone to a pawn shop in Port Elizabeth. When he arrived there, the pawn shop owner handed over the cell phone and something else the same man had pawned, a car radio, which Rousseau confirmed belonged to the Toyota Taz Marlene had hired. When the pawn shop owner produced the name of the man who'd brought the phone and radio in, the mystery deepened. Rousseau had expected to see the name Rob Crowley on the form, but instead, a new name jumped out at him, Dave McGraw. When run through databases, the name produced the same result as Rob Crowley, absolutely nothing. On the 8th of January, a group of people hiking through the Knysna Forest came across a rucksack with clothing and documents scattered about it. When one of the group spotted the name Marlene Koenigs on a document, they immediately backed away and called police. Police wondered whether Marlene may be in the area, so a grid search commenced in the forest and surrounding area. 2 days later, a towel belonging to Marlene and a pair of her underwear were found in a ravine not far from where the rucksack had been found. That was all the search revealed, though, and there was still no sign of Marlene. The credit card receipts were signed Martin Koenigs, McGraw Ellis Koenigs, M.E. Koenigs, and finally, the sadly ironic M. Money, who used the card as collateral and then fled the establishment without paying. On the 13th of January, Colesberg police discovered an abandoned Toyota Taz on the outskirts of their town. Detective Pitful Yun was alerted and confirmed that the vehicle was the same one that Marlene had rented. The car appeared to have been meticulously cleaned, but one single fingerprint was lifted from the vehicle's logbook, which had been in the cubbyhole. Finally, the Department of Home Affairs would resolve the mystery of the man with the endless aliases. When they submitted the fingerprint, it came back as belonging to Ferdinand Mostert. Police were now hot on the heels of Mostert, and by projecting his possible route, they put out an alert to all the hotels in Uppington to keep a lookout for the man. Sure enough, on the 14th of January, the owner of Yebor Guesthouse made a whispered call to police. The man they sought was standing in the reception of his establishment. Police advised the man to behave normally and let the man check into a room. They were on their way. At 7:40 in the evening, Pitful Yun knocked on the door of the room he believed Ferdinand Mostert to be occupying. The man who answered denied that his name was Mostert, and instead introduced himself as Dave McGraw. Pitful Yun was willing to go with the ruse for the moment and told Mostert that either way, he could definitely help with their investigation. Fuljun had brought along a pair of shorts and a t-shirt for Mostert, and he had the man change into those clothes and then bagged and labelled every single item in Mostert's possession. Mostert seemed to realise that the gig was up, but he had one last trick up his sleeve. A method he'd learned from other prisoners during one of his many stays behind bars. As the policeman and Mostert drove, the man suddenly claimed to be suffering from memory loss. As the road passed, though, he suddenly started to have mental flashes of trees and a sign that said Barrydale. When they neared Barrydale, Mostert had further flashes of memory which led police to the Trudeau Pass. As they neared the area where a section of fence was flattened and the slope dropped down to the river below, Mostert told them to pull over. The group stumbled down the slope, and at the bottom they found the now severely decomposed body of Marlene Koenigs. The young woman had lain in the intense heat of the Western Cape summer, partially submerged in the marshland surrounding the river, for 17 days. Detectives were shocked at the cold-blooded murder and disposal of the young woman. Viljoen arrested Ferdinand Mostert for the murder of Marleen Konings at the bottom of that slope. In court, Mostert would attempt to pass off the young woman's death as an accident. Her parents flew in for the trial, and Detective Piet Viljoen apologized to them for having to testify about the horrific conditions of Marleen's remains in their presence. There had been no hope for a visual identification of Marleen. Her face had been bloated and decomposed beyond recognition. Instead, dental records were sent from the Netherlands, and this served to identify her body. Mostert claimed that he had no motive to have killed Marleen. The young woman was his friend, he claimed. Of course, he could not explain why he would then go on to take great financial advantage of his so-called friend's death by selling her belongings, stealing her rental car, and fraudulently using her credit card for weeks. The cold-blooded murder of Marleen Konings made international news, and messages of condolence came in from as far as South Korea and Mexico. In reviewing Mostert's history, Detective Piet Viljoen had also decided to charge the man with another murder, that of Michael Victor, more than a decade before, as well as the attempted murder of warder Piet Moelman, who'd been so kind to Mostert. Ferdinand Mostert was found guilty of all charges against him. He was handed down a life sentence for Marleen's murder, as well as a further 81 years for the other charges. Mostert wept as his sentence was handed down, claiming that he would spend his time in prison studying law to prove his innocence. In a letter to Marleen's family, he wrote, quote, "You've lost a wonderful child, and I have lost a good friend. Your loss is bigger than mine, and I will always pray for you." End quote. Marleen knew Mostert for a grand total of 4 days before he put a bullet in her head so that he could steal her belongings. She never even knew his real name and likely had no idea what his true intentions were until it was too late. Clearly, Mostert had a rather warped view of what a friend is. "We don't shoot our friends in the head, Ferdinand. We don't drug them and leave them for dead on the side of the road." But of course, Ferdinand Mostert just had to make it all about him. Marleen's mother said in aggravation of sentence, quote, "When your child dies, something in you dies as well. It's like an amputation without anesthetic." End quote. The Konings family erected a memorial stone at the scene of the murder. Friends of Marleen and those who'd come into contact with her in South Africa placed notes and flowers there. One from her close friend and would-be boyfriend Jensen read, quote, "My dearest Markie, a number of months has passed. It is still so unreal that you, my girl, are no longer here. Marleen, you are so deep in my heart, and I so much want you to know that you'll be there forever. I kiss you, Jensen." End quote. In the weeks and months that followed the sentencing, after the shock had started to wear off, the Konings family sent out letters of thanks to those involved in the case. P.I. Leon Rousseau received an email from Marleen's father, Edwin, thanking him for his work on the case. He said, quote, "Everywhere in the world there are stupid fools, but we've experienced that there are many good people in the world too, and this gives us the strength to continue on." End quote. The family expressed how vital the discovery of Marleen's remains had been to them. Quote, "For us it was so important because now we have Marleen back and we've given her a place where we can visit her, pray and say hello." End quote. On the 10-year anniversary of Marleen's murder, her parents published a message in a Dutch newspaper. Quote, "You were ripped away from us in the most horrific of ways, but no one can steal your memory from our hearts. End quote. The name of the pass where Marlene was murdered comes from a combination of two Khoi words. The translation means a path for women. Marlene Koenigs had not intended for that place to be the end of her path. But thanks to Ferdinand Mostert, it was. This man who had spent his life doing nothing but hurting others and stealing from those who tried to be kind to him saw fit to end the life of someone who was the polar opposite of him. Almost a decade before that, he'd taken the life of Michael Victor, who, although admittedly having made enormous mistakes of his own in his life, seemed to be set on a brighter and more stable future. I do wonder whether Ferdinand Mostert, with all his aliases and spun stories, hadn't perhaps committed other murders that we don't know about. Ferdinand Mostert is required to serve 25 years in prison before being eligible for parole. In some cases, those sentenced to life may be given early permission to apply for parole after they turn 65, as long as they've served 15 years of their sentence. It is extremely difficult to figure out the status of incarcerated offenders in South Africa, sometimes even for the family of the victims. If Ferdinand Mostert is still alive and serving his sentence, he has, as at 2021, served 16 years, and he is 62 years old. From my understanding, he may then be allowed to be considered for parole in 3 years' time when he turns 65. I truly hope that if that day comes, the parole board takes into consideration how extensive this man's record is. He is the epitome of unrehabilitatable, and he has proven it over and over again. He has also proven that he is very capable of convincing even prison warders that he's ready to live a clean life. But that has always been just another one of this man's tall tales. I'm releasing this episode around the same time that Marlene and Mostert met, 18 years ago. If I close my eyes, I can picture her with her deeply tanned skin, wide smile and bright eyes, greeting this friendly man she's met at her place of accommodation. As I picture the scene, I want to reach out to her through time and tell her to turn around and walk away. I want to tell her that everything is not as it seems and that this man will be the end of her. I know that in a few days he will lead her down a slope in a beautiful mountain pass and he will cold-bloodedly take her life. But I can't reach back through time. And what played out will play out regardless. It would be easy to say that Marlene was too trusting, too kind, too much of everything. All the things that Mostert took advantage of. But really, she was just enough of those things. Her downfall was not her kindness and compassion. It was a very simple twist of fate. If her friend's mother hadn't gotten sick, if Marlene had just decided to stay in Cape Town. But why should she have had to change anything? The cruel twist of fate here was that Ferdinand Mostert had decided his comfort was worth more than her life. Remove that aspect from the equation, and Marlene would have continued driving her rented Toyota Taz to Cape Town. She would have enjoyed New Year's with her friends, and then she would have returned to her home country with a heart full of memories. She did eventually return. But when she did, all that was left was the memories. I think it is clear from the statements of her parents that they do not hold South Africa as a country responsible for their daughter's death. They understand that fools live all over the world. And their daughter just happened to find one of them right here. Marlene Koenigs and Michael Victor, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.